This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It was a triumphant night for anti-establishment candidates. Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Bernie Sanders won impressive victories in New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary, both men gaining substantial momentum for the next contests in South Carolina and Nevada. The other big story out of the Granite State, Ohio Governor John Kasich's strong second-place showing in a crowded field, and in third place, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, a result that bolsters him, too, given low expectations about how well his strong social conservative message would play in New Hampshire. Today in The Exchange, we wrap up these results as the Granite State sends an altered field to South Carolina and Nevada. Let's hear from you, your reaction to the outcome, your thoughts on the primary process this time around, whether it's the issues that mattered, or the debates, the outside money, or the sheer number of candidates. Give us a call, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Josh Rogers is here, NHPR's senior political reporter. Josh, thank you so much for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Ken Rudin. His website is krpoliticaljunkie.com. Ken is also a former NPR political editor. And Ken, welcome back. We had a good night last night, and here we are again.
We did. Good morning.
And Andy Smith is also here, associate professor of political science at UNH and director of the UNH Survey Center. And Andy, thank you so much for your time as
well. Great to see you.
Well, all of you, the narrative this whole campaign season has been the year of the anti-establishment. Andy, to you first, how much was that narrative bolstered last night?
Well, I think on both sides, the anti-establishment or the traditional anti-establishment mood of the country was certainly evident. But I think we have to start to think about party establishments as something more than just the people down in D.C. On the Republican side, one of the things that I found was most fascinating about this campaign throughout was that the establishment candidates, particularly Jeb Bush and John Kasich, were just getting hammered on conservative talk radio. About 20% of Republicans in the state listened to it regularly, either daily or several times a week. And those were the people that went much more strongly for Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. So I think that's a counter-establishment within the Republican Party that has been growing, and it's extremely difficult for any candidate on the Republican side to be able to be successful without at least having not necessarily the blessing, but not the antipathy of that group.
Yeah. What do you think, Ken Rudin?
I agree completely. I mean, antipathy exists not only on the presidential field with the presidential voters, but look what's going on in Congress. As you mentioned, Washington, D.C., the rank-and-file Republican members of Congress forced John Boehner out because he was too establishment, too willing to compromise. Compromise is a dirty word, and basically that's what both Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are running on.
Yeah, and Josh, jump in there, too. You know, everybody said it's a good year for anti-establishment candidates, and that certainly was borne out.
Well, it's also very true on the Democratic side. I mean, if you had asked any of us, you know, way back when, if we were anticipating that Hillary Clinton would suffer as decisive a loss as she did here in New Hampshire to Bernie Sanders, I don't think any of us could have predicted that. And while Sanders' performance was predicted, you know, in the polling leading up to this, the span of his victory, you know, winning voters in every category, outpolling Clinton among women, according to exit polls, pretty much everywhere he won, in the cities where you'd expect Clinton to do well, and, you know, in the towns where you might have expected Sanders to have an edge.
And look at the map from 2012. Look at the areas on the Republican side where Mitt Romney won and Ron Paul won, two different wings of the Republican Party. Donald Trump carried them both last night.
Well, while we're talking about Senator Sanders, you know, as you said, Josh, everyone predicted victories for Senator Sanders, but it was resounding. Here's Senator Sanders, his take on what the message is from this very strong victory.
Together, we have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California. And that is that the government of our great country belongs to all of the people and not just a handful of wealthy campaign contributors and their super PACs.
Andy Smith, you've been watching the electorate as director of the UNH Survey Center. How surprised were you by the very wide margin over which Bernie Sanders beat Hillary Clinton?
Not really. The key for yesterday, to me, was looking at what the turnout was going to be. And once it appeared the turnout was going to be high, it was not an unexpected win of that magnitude. What we were seeing in our polls leading up to that was among first-time voters and young voters who hadn't voted before, Sanders was getting well over 80% support, just astoundingly
80%
high.
80%
among
younger voters. Among
younger voters. And it's the thing I'm seeing on the Democratic side, and I think this started back in 2004, there's really a generational shift going on within that party, and the Clinton team didn't even see it coming. They should have seen it in 2008 because I think that was part of it. Boy, they didn't see it this time.
Let's hear Hillary Clinton talking about her efforts to reach younger voters and how those efforts, as you say, Andy, fell down.
I know I have some work to do, particularly with young people, but I will repeat again what I have said this week. Even if they are not supporting me now, I support them. Because I know I've had a blessed life, but I also know what it's like to stumble and fall. And so many people across America know that feeling. And we've learned it's not whether you get knocked down that matters, it's whether you get back up.
Okay, so Ken Rudin, after this pretty bruising defeat here in New Hampshire, how does Hillary Clinton get back up?
Well, you know, when I heard her words just now, I was confused whether she was talking last night or 2008, because the word on Hillary Clinton all along in this cycle was that she learned from the mistakes of 2008. She would promise never to be out-organized again and out-maneuvered again. And yet somehow this 74-year-old guy who's been in Congress since 1991, who's hardly a new face, yet he captured the imagination of the Democratic electorate.
She was out-energized, perhaps, maybe not outspent or out-organized, but out-energized by that energy that Bernie Sanders captured.
But the good news for Hillary Clinton is she knows that the last three presidents, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, all lost New Hampshire. So maybe she'll think it's a trend for her, and she could win the presidency without winning New Hampshire.
Well, and Josh Rogers, the Clinton camp has attributed some of this to Sanders living next door in Vermont. How much can they really make that case?
Well, I don't think that's terribly plausible. Sanders was not well-known in New Hampshire, certainly not as well-known as Hillary Clinton. And the spillover in terms of the political cultures of New Hampshire and Vermont is pretty minimal, particularly given the media markets are not really something that's shared. It would be one thing if you were from Massachusetts.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us as we wrap up last night's results and look ahead, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Your reaction to the outcome last night, your thoughts on just how the primary process went this time around, whether it was the issues that came to the forefront or the outside money spent or the large number of candidates or the debates. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, let's go to our listeners. And Douglas is calling from Berlin. Hi, Douglas. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I was surprised about Trump, but I think that Cruz will have a better time down in South Carolina. I don't think New Hampshire is willing to give up on Trump.
Who were you hoping would win last night, Douglas? Was Trump your guy or Cruz?
Cruz.
Cruz. Okay. And let's talk about Ted Cruz. Andy Smith, you know, we kept saying last night that most people expected Trump to win. So the real race was who would get the silver and the gold, the silver and the bronze, and Cruz got the bronze.
That's not too surprising in that after Ben Carson really disappointed in Iowa, support among social conservatives and kind of more traditional conservatives didn't have much place to go. Rand Paul had dropped out, and that kind of left Cruz alone to get that vote. New Hampshire doesn't have a large evangelical vote like other states do, but when you put it together within a wide number of candidates like that, it's easy to see how he could come in that position just because he got most of the vote that he was realistically able to get.
So post-Iowa kind of worked for him.
I think it was a great night for Ted Cruz because New Hampshire was supposed to be a push for him. It was supposed to be a brief stopping point between Iowa and South Carolina. Iowa with the evangelical vote, South Carolina with a pretty substantial evangelical vote. Those voters were never present in New Hampshire. He was not supposed to do as well as he did, and beating Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and others on that list, I think it was a good night for him.
Let's hear from Senator Cruz last night, again talking about the expectations for him in New Hampshire and how he did very well.
Once again, the talking heads and the Washington insiders were confident that our wave of support would break against the rock of the Granite State. That a conservative, we were told, could not do well in the state of New Hampshire. We were told that over and over again, and tonight the men and women here and all across this great state proved them wrong.
So there's Ted Cruz again announcing his third place showing. And Josh Rogers, who were some of the familiar conservative faces here in the Granite State that backed Senator Cruz?
Former U.S. Senator Bob Smith, former House Speaker Bill O'Brien, Executive Counselor David Wheeler. You know, he did a good job of getting, you know, hardcore conservative supporters. And while he didn't spend a heck of a lot of time here overall, he, you know, came here before the caucuses and, you know, his people were fairly organized. And as Andy said, he was a natural place for that sort of vote to go.
Andy?
Well, one of the things that Cruz had going for them is one of his super PACs had invested heavily in analytics going into this campaign, more so than many of the other candidates, arguably more so than even Bush and Kasich, who had good ground games here. And even though there weren't that many conservative voters, particularly socially conservative voters, they knew who they were and how to get to them.
Again, our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And let's go next to Amherst, where Katie's on the air. Hi, Katie. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, after watching every debate, Republican and Democratic, from start to finish.
Wow, Katie.
Why hasn't one moderator asked what the candidates are going to do about the $19 trillion debt, which I find the most important issue, aside from climate change, which is causing huge destabilization in places like Syria, where the three-year drought is what started people in rural areas going to urban areas, therefore causing more and more destabilization, poverty, violence, crime, leading to the rise of ISIS. But most importantly, my question is, why hasn't the debt been addressed, not once, and climate change for that matter?
Well, let's tackle that, Katie, and thank you for the call. And Ken, Democrats did talk about climate change. Republicans, Katie's right, not so much.
Well, the Republicans talked about it, but they dismissed that as a theory, whereas Bernie Sanders had said over and over again, matter of fact, he was ridiculed for that when there was a conversation about foreign policy and what to do about ISIS. He said that the greatest threat, the external threat facing the United States was climate change. And of course, people rolled their eyes, but in many ways, you know, we knew what he was talking about.
And John Kasich did address the debt, right, Josh Rogers? He had a debt clock that he would carry around to some of his events.
Yes, something familiar from past campaigns. And he had a plan that he liked to talk about that would bring the budget into balance, I think, you know, over 10 years and or maybe 20 years, but, you know, address fiscal issues. I mean, that was something that he tended to focus on.
It is interesting, though, Katie's point, and I appreciate your call, Katie, because, Josh, when this whole campaign season started, you know, the narrative was that it would be more about the economy and income equality and maybe on, you know, debt and deficits. And then it pretty quickly pivoted to national security concerns.
Yes, I mean, it's unclear whether those actually drove the votes of either party ultimately. I mean, certainly, you know, Hillary Clinton was hoping that that was going to be something that would help her in the Democratic primary. And, you know, Donald Trump's constellation of concerns are a bit of a grab bag, but I don't think there's any indication that people flock to him for that reason.
Yeah, I'd like your thoughts on that too, Andy, issues.
I think Josh is exactly right that the economic issues were important and income inequality, particularly on the Democratic side. And I think this is like the key to why Hillary Clinton lost so badly. That entire debate that they had during the fall and over January and February was fought on Bernie Sanders' turf, with the exception of that couple weeks right after the San Bernardino and Paris attacks, when we had some focus on foreign policy and terrorism. When the Democrats were fighting over economic issues, Clinton moved further and further and further to the left, and Sanders didn't budge. And that, to me, was an indication that if you're fighting over on your opponent's turf, you're losing.
Ken?
And, of course, on the Republican side, while terrorism was a key issue, I don't know, as Josh says, whether they flocked to Donald Trump because of that issue, but they certainly moved away from Ben Carson, who showed in one debate where he was so completely unfamiliar with how to deal with the price crisis, who the major players were, and that began the long spiral down for Ben Carson.
Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Peggy, who says, I think Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the cable news networks, the national news outlets all work together in their zeal to sell Clinton and actually helped elect Bernie Sanders. The mindset that Hillary was a done deal and all the support from the media would ensure her victory was offensive to many voters, not just young voters. Peggy goes on to say, the final nail in the Clinton coffin to me was the gathering last weekend of all the heavy hitter women, including Gloria Steinem, Barbara Boxer, and her extremely offensive remark about a place in hell for those who weren't helping Hillary Clinton. Peg, thanks for the email. Actually, just to correct the record, that remark was made by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. But Josh Rogers, I'd love to get your take on this whole women controversy surrounding Clinton, especially towards the end of the campaign.
Well, certainly the final 10 days or so, that was a push in the Clinton campaign. I covered the event that she had in Manchester, where I think there were four U.S. senators there, and it was very much, we need to get out the women's vote. And that was something that certainly helped Hillary Clinton 8 years ago when she faced Senator Obama. The exit polling showed that that was crucial to her maintaining an edge. This time around, you know, the exit polling suggests that Bernie Sanders carried women overall and young women overwhelmingly. And I think that the Clinton campaign's inability to leverage, you know, her status as potentially the first female president into something that would drive women to the polls was something that was confounding to them.
And I think this is part of that that thing that I was talking about earlier, that the party has changed. Younger women don't see the same issues with sexism that their parents, their mothers or their grandmothers saw. They probably had college professors that were women, bosses that were women. They may be bosses of companies or of themselves as women. And for them, a first woman president probably would be nice, but it's not part of the way they've experienced life. We tend to, as we get older, we all kind of remember things the way they were, and we assume that that's always that way. And I think that's what's happened with the Clinton campaign. They were just out of step with much of the younger part of the Democratic electorate.
A little tone deaf, then, Andy, you're saying.
I think it's more than a little tone deaf. Similarly, on the issue of socialism, saying Bernie Sanders is a socialist, well, for young voters, they don't remember the Berlin Wall. They don't remember the Soviet Union and the Gulag. What they see as socialism is maybe their trip to Europe last summer and how nice it was in Paris. They don't remember the other parts.
Ken?
And entrance polls actually in Iowa showed that 43% of the Democratic electorate described themselves as socialists. So that was not the kind of slur that you would think back in the 1950s. I will say one thing, though. When we talk about history in the making, there was a clear history in the making in 2008. The power of Barack Obama among African-American voters was significant, was overwhelming. Hillary Clinton didn't talk about women in 2008. She talked more about it in 2016.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll talk more about the Republicans, especially Donald Trump, what helped fuel his victory here in the Granite State. And we'll take a lot more of your comments. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, post-Granite State presidential primary analysis. Let's hear from you. Let's get your take on last night's results and how the process itself unfolded over the past year here in New Hampshire. Again, the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Josh Rogers is here, NHPR's senior political reporter, along with Andy Smith, associate professor of political science at UNH and director of the UNH Survey Center, and Ken Rudin, political analyst. His website is krpoliticaljunkie.com. He's a former NPR political editor. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Guys, before we go back to our listeners, we should talk about Donald Trump, a strong showing, a very crowded field, and he comes out clearly on top. Andy Smith, what helped fuel this victory?
Well, I think it was interesting last night that we spent more time talking about John Kasich and the number two people because we assumed Donald Trump was
going to win. Or Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and so forth.
But the fascinating thing about Donald Trump is that throughout this campaign, we were trying to figure out what the Donald Trump voter looked like, what kind of person he was. And what we were seeing in our polls, and I think in the exit polls you're seeing this as well, he had strong support across the board among Republicans. And two pockets that I saw that were kind of interesting. First off, as I mentioned earlier, talk radio listeners really liked Donald Trump and Ted Cruz to a lesser extent. But they were maybe channeling some of the anger that you sometimes hear there. Secondly, non-religious Republicans, people that never go to church, which is a different kind of group for Republicans nationwide. But here in the Northeast, we see that. And he was particularly strong among that group.
Secular Republicans.
Secular Republicans,
business people Republicans.
Yeah, they're angry, but they aren't attracted to the Ted Cruz sort of socially conservative vote. Not quite libertarian, but they're mad.
Josh, you covered Trump. What's your sense of who was drawn to his campaign?
Well, the campaign's had, and I found this, a lot of the people who support him were people who had either become disaffected with politics as they understood them or people who hadn't participated. I talked to several people who were essentially fanatically supportive of Donald Trump and said they had never had any involvement with politics. I interviewed a man last night who had had some role in every Trump event in northern New England, he said, doing sort of advance work, moving chairs, like whatever it took. And this was after never really participating in politics for his entire adult life. And so there were a lot of people like that, but there were a lot of people who it's like, who does a Donald Trump voter look like? I mean, I guess, it looks like New Hampshire.
Yeah, across the board, really. And that was one of the interesting things that came out last night. And we had Dante Scala here sort of picking apart the demographics. And Ken, he said just what Josh says, the Trump voter is sort of all over and every man and woman.
And what's I keep using the word remarkable because so much of this is remarkable. But if you remember when George W. Bush and the war in Iraq got underway, there were a lot of critics of the war who said that the mainstream or the lamestream media failed to do its job. Well, the mainstream media was all over Donald Trump from the beginning. Every misstatement, every contradiction that he would make from the past, they went over and over again. His comments about women and Mexicans and Muslims and the disabled and his fellow Republicans, and yet clear winner, as Andy and Josh said, clear winner last night.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Donald Trump's victory speech last night.
First of all, congratulations to Bernie. In all fairness, we have to congratulate him. We may not like it, but I heard parts of Bernie's speech. He wants to give away our country, folks. He wants to give away. We're not going to let it happen. We're not going to let it happen. I don't know where it's going with Bernie. We wish him a lot of luck, but we are going to make America great again, but we're going to do it the old-fashioned way. We're going to beat China, Japan. We're going to beat Mexico at trade. We're going to beat all of these countries that are taking so much of our money away from us on a daily basis.
Again, that's Donald Trump last night in his victory speech. Ken Rudin, how do you hear Republicans, including Mr. Trump, maybe having to start to retool their messages as Bernie Sanders had that amazing night last night?
You mean how Trump has to recalculate or how
his, most Republicans are going to have to start sort of talking differently. Not that Bernie Sanders is going to be the nominee or Hillary Clinton's going to be the nominee. We don't know. But they have to start taking him seriously.
Yes, yes. But I think also think of what happened last night. The angry man, Donald Trump, was the clear winner on the Republican side. The guy who came in second place was the nice guy, the guy who was not attacked, did not attack fellow Republicans. He didn't do anything, which was John Kasich. So I don't know what kind of a message that was, but all I know, as long as there are more Kasichs and Rubios and Bushes who stay in the race, it just and they battle among themselves, it allows the top of the field to be Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, which is the worst thing the so-called establishment wants to see.
Go ahead, Josh. Yeah.
Well, one thing that's interesting about Trump is the way in which his policy positions, such as he articulates them, don't really hew to any kind of like Republican orthodoxy. And that's one thing that people within the Republican Party who aren't fans of Donald Trump, and there are a decent number of them, are confused by that, you know, he was for this and now he's for that, and that he talks about he has a slightly protectionist attitude about trade. He talks about maintaining social safety net programs without change. He talks about using the power of government to negotiate prescription drug prices, which is something you more often hear from Democrats. And, you know, a lot of people in his audience are, you know, have their sort of fists in the air throughout this as well as throughout the kind of more traditional red meat stuff, he says. And so, you know, it's an interesting moment to think about whether or not, you know, things that always people always assumed were necessarily have to be part of a successful Republican candidate's set of beliefs. Maybe that's changing.
Well, I think that's exactly the key, because what you're seeing with Trump is, in my view, that he's looking at what is popular among a broad swath of Americans that is not necessarily consistent at all, but saying, okay, Social Security is possible for popular among people, Republicans and Democrats. I'll be supportive of Social Security. Americans right now aren't very happy about immigration into the country. Both Republicans and Democrats, particularly blue-collar workers who might be losing their jobs, are upset about that, so he goes against that. China and imports, weakness in the United States abroad. These are things that, in general, are popular. You don't have to be specific about these sorts of things because he's tapping into a broad panoply of popular issues, and they aren't consistent, but most voters aren't consistent in their effort. They're not ideological voters, and particularly in a state like New Hampshire where you have high turnout, they're just regular folks out there. They're not the activists and the ideologues who hew closely to an orthodoxy. They are going to go for what somebody tells them they're going to deliver for what is concerning to them.
But these Republican voters used to be that way. You don't think so? Because no. I think when Mitt Romney, when he said, well, he had Romney care, and so therefore that wasn't true conservative position. John McCain was for campaign finance. That was not a true conservative position. Nelson Rockefeller, you know, if you go back that far, talked about positions he had in the past. Once upon a time, there was an ideological litmus test on the Republican side. That is definitely not the case with Donald Trump.
Well, in New Hampshire, I think you're right. There's been a shift. I think the only time that we saw that real ideological test was with the Reagan administration, and then maybe with Pat Buchanan, which was kind of like he's carrying the flag of Reagan in 92 and 96. If you think of who's won here after that point, John McCain running as a moderate, definitely. John McCain again in 2008, and Mitt Romney. None of these guys are conservative in any matter. Not conservative by Republican orthodoxy. And the state hasn't been conservative. Even in the 1960s, Barry Goldwater runs in 1964. He finishes it behind Henry Cabot Lodge in a write-in campaign.
Where is Margaret Chase Smith when we need her?
Let's go back to the phones, gentlemen. Again, the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Lots of emails coming in as well. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to Paul, waiting in Rochester. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine.
I'm concerned about all the half-truths and misdirection and flat-out lies throughout this entire campaign on both sides of the fence. And I believe that if they get caught out in a lie, fact-checked, caught Cruz and a whole bunch of them, I think they should be disqualified flat-out. I don't think there should be any argument. Maybe we could get some truth in these discussions.
So too much lying and half-truths in the primary process. Ken, do you want to comment?
You know, a few years ago, there's a group called PolitiFact, and they would truth squad every debate, every speech, and it was a popular thing in the media, on the newspapers, and people would pay attention to it, and it did not change the candidates' behavior one bit. I mean, you think about lying in politics, that goes back as far as anyone can remember. It hasn't changed this time at all, even though you have allegedly a more scrupulous media.
Let's take an email here from Nick that just came in from Hampstead. He says, why is everybody giving so much of the credit to Sanders organizing ability and not his message. Nick says it was the message that resonated with me, not the organization. I've been voting in presidential elections since 1972, and in very few elections did I have the chance to vote for somebody instead of against the other one. Nick says, I didn't vote against Clinton. I voted for Bernie and his consistent positions. Andy, you want to jump in there?
Absolutely. Bernie Sanders has essentially given the same speech since he first ran for office in the 1970s, and its times have now finally come around to where Bernie Sanders is rather than the other way around. The fact that so many young people were attracted to him, these are people that were new to the new to politics, is an indication that his message was resonating much more strongly, and his campaign became those young volunteers that came to him, not the organization that he built to reach out and pull people in. It was they were forcing him, essentially. He had no shortage of volunteers in that organization.
Nick, thanks for the email. Ken?
And Nick is exactly right. If you think of Bernie Sanders' position on Iraq, on trade policy, on the Keystone Pipeline, on same-sex marriage, that has never, ever changed. Hillary Clinton's positions on all four of those issues have shifted over the years.
Here's another email. This is from Andy in the Upper Valley. He says, after the Obama revolution of 2008, I must admit that I am not optimistic that Bernie Sanders' revolution will actually achieve much of what he is campaigning for. Obama's campaign promised hope and change. Look where we are now. Why do people voting for Sanders think this will happen this time? The same divisions and obstructionist politics from the right are still at play in Congress. Andy, thank you for that email. And Josh Rogers, that's an argument that Hillary Clinton made, that, yeah, this all sounds good, but it's not achievable.
And that's a question we put to Senator Sanders when he came to the studios here. And he said that he had great regard for President Obama, save for the critique that he believes that Obama kind of unplugged the movement that supported his candidacy once he got to Washington. Now, you know, that's what Senator Sanders says. He says that he would use the public will to get Congress to get with his program. That, you know, would be a steep order. He's got to get elected first, but that's what he says.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Gentlemen, I want to return to John Kasich. Again, he got that second place ticket out of New Hampshire last night. And Andy Smith, first off, just what do you make of that?
Couple things. Near the end, voters are going to look for somebody that they can gravitate to. And the message that occurs at the end, I think, is somewhat important. And the debate on Saturday night, he did. We remember the conflict between Bush and Trump, the conflict between Rubio and Christie. The guy who stayed out of that, with the exception of Ben Carson, but the guy who stayed out of it was Kasich. And I think that's a key point that you see. That's why you don't really want to go negative, especially at the end of the campaign. Let somebody else do the work for you. And I think he floated up a little bit. And polls, they can't catch those things because, you know, that event happened Saturday night. Polls on Monday or Tuesday may be able to get that. And I think we're just seeing the impact of the debate by the time the election results came in.
Well, let's hear what Kasich himself said about that positive message, Andy, last night.
Something big happened tonight. And let me tell you what it is. Let me tell you what it is. We have had tens and tens of millions of dollars spent against us with negative advertising, okay? We have. We've had tens of millions. See, that's the old politics. That's the old politics. We never went negative because we have more good to sell than to spend our time being critical of somebody else. And maybe, maybe just maybe, at a time when clearly change is in the air, maybe just maybe we are turning the page on a dark part of American politics, because tonight the light overcame the darkness of negative campaigning.
Okay, Ken Rudin, this one's for you. I mean, are we going to see other candidates going, going positive? Work for John Kasich, maybe I'll try it too.
Let me think for a second, no. And here's the reason why. I mean, remember when Marco Rubio came out of Iowa with a full head of steam, he became the target. The crosshairs were on him. Everybody was out to get him. I wonder what's going to happen to John Kasich now that he's suddenly the media darling, the establishment darling, at least out of New Hampshire, what happens in subsequent races. But we did learn, to your point, though, we did learn that when Christie and Rubio went at it, a lot of people are referring to it as a murder-suicide, because not only did Christie take down Marco Rubio in New Hampshire, he hurt his own cause as well.
Well, it's interesting, Josh, we've been talking about what a great night it was for anti-establishment candidates. On the other hand, you don't get more establishment than John Kasich, right? I mean, longtime congressman, and Ohio governor and so forth, so...
Well, he certainly has a long political resume in Washington and now in Ohio, and he did a good job of marshaling support from a lot of New Hampshire's GOP establishment. It's unclear precisely what that support's worth, but it's sort of support that you might have expected would have gone towards Governor Bush. You know, Tom Rath. He had former Senator Sununu, Ruth Griffin. How much weight any of those people have these days is hard to say, but certainly on paper, it looks pretty good. And, while Kasich talked about a positive message, I mean, there was still super PAC spending on his behalf
that wasn't
entirely positive. But, for people in New Hampshire, John Kasich also kind of kissed the ring of New Hampshire primary traditions, by necessity, really. But he, made it work for him, and he liked town hall meetings. That came across if you went to his events. He enjoyed it. He enjoyed meeting with voters. And, he campaigned as someone who acted as if he wasn't terribly concerned with how it turned out because, he was going to try to be himself. And I think voters did like that. And I also think that Andy's right that, the last few days, a lot of people drifted towards him, by dint of his positive message. And a lot of undecided voters I talked to who were heading to the polls, who were narrowing it down between several candidates and were walking in there, Kasich was among their two or three choices. And I think a lot of those people probably voted for him.
Andy?
I think one thing that's interesting, we get on the message of negative campaigning. We saw a lot from the Bush campaign, particularly a super PAC. If you think about the guy who maybe didn't go negative as a campaign, it actually was Donald Trump. He was very blunt when he criticized people directly, but it was like open criticism directly to their face. It wasn't like he had somebody else in a campaign and somebody else out here spreading things around. He just bluntly told them to their face that they were wrong. So to me, Trump is just a unique phenomenon in that he is not following the typical rules, but to a certain extent, despite some of his misstatements, he seemed like an honest guy by the voters who support him.
Let's take another call. This is Wayne in Dover. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I had a comment I wanted, hoping you and your guests could comment on, and that is I think the success of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in their respective parties is because they're actually campaigning and saying what they're going to do as president. They may be pie-in-the-sky statements that we think are not going to happen, but I think that's resonating with voters. Here are people that are telling me what they're going to do.
So if I could ask, Wayne, you don't have to answer, who'd you vote for?
I supported Kasich. One of the reasons being I think in a national election he has the potential to put Ohio, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Colorado into play, and that would be good for the Republicans.
All right, so you're looking ahead to electability. What do you think, Andy? This picks up on what you said, that even though he's a Kasich supporter, Trump and Sanders, their appeal was they didn't varnish how they felt about things.
Well, they certainly did talk about the future. It's that they have very different visions of the future for America. And you could argue that Trump's looking backwards. You could argue that Sanders is looking backwards to a different kind of politics. But they were talking about looking ahead rather than the issues of the past couple years.
All right. Well, Wayne, good to hear from you. And we'll take more of your questions and comments after a short break. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll also catch up with the campaigns of Marco Rubio and Chris Christie. So stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, analysis of New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation presidential primary, and in a few minutes, where the candidates might go from here. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. Josh Rogers is here, NHPR's senior political reporter, along with Andy Smith, director of the UNH Survey Center and an associate professor at UNH. Also, Ken Rudin, political analyst. His website is krpoliticaljunkie.com. He's a former NPR political editor. One more time, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, we should talk about Marco Rubio. And as we said earlier, Josh Rogers, you know, hopes were high for Senator Rubio when he arrived here in New Hampshire, fresh off his strong third place showing in Iowa. What happened to Senator Rubio in the Granite State?
Well, I mean, he hasn't spent much time here, and he – I think that his debate – probably the debate did hurt him. He acknowledged as much. You know, Senator Rubio, he's – for a lot of voters early on were eager to have him come here more. A lot of people said, oh, he's sort of in my top three. And National Republicans certainly see him as an attractive kind of vessel for this – for classic kind of American exceptionalist sort of land of opportunity message. You know – It didn't quite pan out for him here, and it's hard to know what his future holds at this point. I mean, he obviously, you know, took a bit of a hit.
Well, let's hear what he said last night, and then I'll go to you as well, Andy and Ken. But here's Marco Rubio again talking, Josh, what you said about that less than stellar debate performance on Saturday night.
But I want you to understand something. I want you to understand something. Our disappointment tonight is not on you. It's on me. It's on me. I did not do well on Saturday night, so listen to this. That will never happen again. That will never happen again. And let me tell you why. Let me tell you why. Let me tell you why it will never happen again. It's not about me. It's not about this campaign. It is about this election. It is about this election. It is about what's at stake in this election. You see, for the last 7 years, we have a president that's been doing tremendous damage to this country.
So what do you think about that, Andy Smith?
Well, Rubio is young. He does, I think, have a really good career ahead of him. So I would say that maybe not this time around, but I could see Rubio being somebody that comes back in 4 years or 8 years and being a very, very formidable person. I think there's a shelf life to candidates. You have to be you really have to go from your first big win to the White House right away. Some people are ready for it, more prepared. I think this just shows us that Rubio was maybe prepared in local legislative politics, but he wasn't prepared yet for the rough and tumble of Washington, got spun around there, and he got caught into that, and particularly his position on immigration. And that looking of that appearance that he was just not ready for prime time yet is really what caught up with him. And he looked young, too.
Coming in fifth in the New Hampshire primary. It's not great, Ken Rudin.
No, it's not. But, I mean, when you think of what he did in Iowa, I mean, he also, as Josh said, yes, he did not spend much time in New Hampshire, but he didn't spend much time in Iowa either. And given, as Andy just said, his role in the Gang of Eight and his work on behalf of immigration overhaul, which was definitely antithetical to what evangelicals believed, and yet he did so well in Iowa. So you think – I think really what happened was people watched the debate. He looked like he was rehearsed. He looked robotic. All that fresh message, the new face, failed to resonate on the debate stage. And I think when Chris Christie just nailed at him, he just had no response. And the campaign was really hurt that night.
How does Marco Rubio, Ken, play in South Carolina and Nevada?
Well, I mean, he's actually had strength in both states. I think, if memory serves, I think Tim Scott, the senator from South Carolina, African-American senator from South Carolina, has endorsed Marco Rubio. Of course, endorsements don't mean that much, as the union leader will tell you with Chris Christie. But, I mean, still, he does have a future there. You know, it was interesting to see both Rubio and Bush getting 11 or 12%, and both of them saying this is a great night for us, which is pretty remarkable. But I guess, you know, if you're still living after Donald Trump gets through with you, that's a good sign.
Did you want to jump in, Josh Rogers, there? Okay, so let's talk about Chris Christie then. And as has been reported this morning, Chris Christie saying, instead of saying, I'm going on to Nevada and South Carolina, he's going to go home to New Jersey and, as he put it, take a breath, think about this. Let's hear from Chris Christie last night, who came in, let's see, sixth. So he sounds pretty defeated. Let's hear.
We came to say that for our seniors, that someone needs to stand up and fix the Social Security system and fix the Medicare system so that it doesn't fail them or bankrupt our country. And we came here to say that speaking your mind matters, that experience matters, that competence matters, and that it will always matter in leading our nation. That message was heard by a lot of folks. And it was stood for by a lot of folks here in New Hampshire. Just not enough. Not enough tonight.
So Josh Rogers, at one point, Chris Christie was the flavor of the week. He was up in the polls. He had that union leader endorsement. He was getting a lot of attention and seemed to have some momentum there.
He did. A lot of the attention he got in the wake of that was not positive. I mean, he was, the sort of fight among the governors for attention. And there was, it was pretty nasty, the mailers that were going back and forth. You could argue that Christie, sort of peaked too early. I mean, but that peaking too early, that was really a comeback. I mean, he... a couple of years ago, he was seen as somebody who really had a chance. He was obviously – some Republicans wanted to draft him to run last time. He was head of the Republican Governors Association. He spent a lot of time up here and elsewhere. At his best, on the campaign trail, he's a really gifted campaigner. He's, kind of an athlete of town halls. He used them in New Jersey. He's good in them here. He has set pieces that can make the old women in the audience cry. He, makes the tough guys feel good about themselves. But
he talks about mom
it
a
was,
lot.
It was, wasn't to be. But, and, we'll see what happens to him in the future.
Ken?
Yeah, I know that he made a lot of people in New Jersey cry, especially when he would say, sit down and shut up, which was what he was known for. There were some Republicans who loved that kind of bravado. There were some who felt that he was a bully. The thing is, once upon a time in the early debates when he was taking on Hillary Clinton, he was moving up in the polls. But then when he started to aim his arrows at fellow Republicans, that and a combination with a failed credit rating in New Jersey, the economy going downhill there, his embrace of President Obama during the Hurricane Sandy, that started to weigh on voters. And I think attacking fellow Republicans just did not help his cause.
Well, Andy?
Related to that, though, I think that he was also a victim of the attacks by the Bush campaign. The Bush campaign made a decision in the fall that they were not going to be able to take down Trump, so they needed to be the last person standing. And they went after all of the other more moderate Republicans, and they particularly went hard after Christie. And Kasich, too, but Christie in particular.
And Rubio.
And Rubio later on they did when he started to bounce up. So
yeah, that Bush super PAC spent a lot of money in New Hampshire. I've got a stack of ads
back
at my desk that I'm going to recycle after this, but boy, they really did go after, especially as you say, Andy, Christie and Rubio, with some ads that were almost funny at some point. They just had a good time with those.
I would have liked to have been one of the creative guys. So Christie's going back to New Jersey. He's either going back to get a head start on the June New Jersey primary, or he's going to really probably pull out.
Well, okay, so let's talk about the other governor in this race. And before the results came in, there was a lot of talk, Ken Rudin, about this cluster of three governors, Chris Christie and John Kasich, current governors, and then former governor Jeb Bush. What's your assessment of how former Governor Bush did last night?
Well, this is a very strange campaign pronouncement. He said, our campaign is not dead. I mean, to me, that's kind of a weird way of saying that. We're moving on to South Carolina. But that is what he said. We always talked about this is the year of the governors. But think of those who have already dropped out. Rick Perry, Bobby Jindal, Scott Walker, Mike Huckabee, George Pataki, who we can't forget, and maybe Chris Christie.
So. And Martin Gilmore. O'Malley.
And Martin O'Malley on the Democrats.
And Jim Gilmore.
No, he's still in.
Oh, that's right.
He got 122 votes. Matter of fact, I'd like to meet those 122 people who voted. Anyway, but the thing is, I think the thought of Jeb Bush saying, we are not dead, is the most remarkable slogan for a bumper sticker I've ever seen.
Well, let's hear how former Governor Bush put it.
The pundits had it all figured out last Monday night when the Iowa caucuses were complete. They said that the race was now a three-person race between two freshman senators and a reality TV star. And while the reality TV star is still doing well, it looks like you all have reset the race. And for that, I am really grateful. Granted, staters understand that this is a race not to be on the back bench of the United States Senate. We're electing the President of the United States. a person that has to make tough decisions.
Again, he says New Hampshire has reset the race. And Andy Smith, you know, that is what Iowa and New Hampshire do. We winnow, we reset, and so forth. How did New Hampshire reset the race last night, to put it like he said?
I think New Hampshire may have reset the race, but not enough for Jeb Bush. He's spinning a distant fourth place finish behind Ted Cruz, who was supposed to do poorly here, period, and saying that that's going to reset the race, and he's now has momentum going forward. Talk about putting a best face on a bad situation. That's really what we've got here with him. The one thing he's got is money.
How do you see things reset, Josh Rogers, after all this?
I'm not sure they reset terribly well for former Governor Bush. I mean, he used to like to refer to himself as a joyful tortoise.
Tortoise.
That's how he was going to run. I mean, and maybe he's back to that. I mean, you know, how it resets race. I mean, I think it's still it'd be interesting to see. I mean, you know, Trump's win here was very big on the Republican side. Every state, you know, for the next few, it's going to be like, well, will this happen again? You know, obviously everyone likes to say, well, there's going to be Trump, there's going to be the outsider, there's going to be the more establishment type. You know, will that actually come to pass, or is this just another sort of construction that everyone repeats over and over again until it's sort of ossified into something that, you know, passes for truth until it, you know, it doesn't? That's what I'm going to be watching for.
There was a big crawl on CNN last night that says George W. Bush and Barbara Bush endorse Jeb Bush. And I thought that was pretty remarkable. I think that could put him over the top.
But apart from Jeb Bush, Ken, how do you see these results from New Hampshire last night resetting the race as we head into, Nevada, South Carolina, but then after that, 30 contests in the space of 2 weeks. So,
you know something, again, the seeming collapse of Marco Rubio. Look, we're not writing his obituary yet, not at all. And he's, you know, he's going to go on and perhaps fight even a better fight. But the fact that there was no alternative to the Cruz-Trump candidacies by proving by Rubio's poor finish yesterday, Kasich's now moving up. I still think that with the establishment Republicans in the circular firing squad attacking each other, it just helps the Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, who's going to probably do very well in the South, and Super Tuesday.
And it does, I mean, it does remain to be seen what happens, you know, if attacks by fellow candidates have much of an effect on Trump. I mean, they, you know, they've sort of poked at him a little bit, but whether or not it was always like, oh, well, when is the big money going to start to be spent against Donald Trump? I mean, I just would be curious to see if that has any effect.
And did you look every time that Jeb Bush would attack him in a debate, Trump would just look at him and say something nasty, and then Jeb would be flummoxed. He just had no response to it. So there's nobody who takes on another candidate like Donald Trump.
You want to jump in, Andy?
No Marcus of Queensbury rules for Donald Trump there, are there. I think that it's important to remember that when you're looking at polls in the subsequent states, to remember that the candidates that were being asked about before Iowa and New Hampshire are not the same candidates as they are now. Now we have winners and losers. And the candidates who won are going to be looked at as winners. So Bernie Sanders' numbers, particularly if you get down to South Carolina and other states, his numbers, I anticipate, are going to go up very high. We've already seen this happen in national polls. This is the importance of New Hampshire. It sets the momentum for going on, because he's going on to the subsequent states. Those states after New Hampshire have not had campaigns per se. They're following at the national level. And most voters there are going to see this guy won, this guy lost. And that's going to be the framework that they look at the campaign in.
So when we hear people say, Andy, well, you know, going into South Carolina or Nevada or Arkansas or Georgia, the polls have shown, that's almost irrelevant, because there's been a total reset.
That's the reset. It's not up here. It's in those subsequent states. You now have winners and you have losers.
I have to ask you guys this question, because I've gotten several emails to this point, and it has to do with delegates. Dave says, I'm seeing a meme on Facebook that although Bernie won by far the popular vote in the Democratic primary, Hillary is enjoying a lead in delegates thanks to super delegates. Can you talk about this? Also following up on this, Martha, she says all the New Hampshire Democratic elected officials supported Hillary Clinton. Bernie won the votes. Who will be the delegates at the convention? Will the official delegates now support the election winner? How are the delegates chosen now? We could probably do a whole half-hour programming on this, but since we've gotten these and a couple other emails, Ken, I did want to ask you.
It's a little too early to be talking about delegates. Eventually, you know, if this race is still going on by April or May, then we'll talk about what you need to get to the nomination. But this is a very important point, that even though Bernie Sanders won overwhelmingly in New Hampshire yesterday, Tuesday. I think all eight superdelegates from New Hampshire all back Hillary Clinton. And I think if you're looking at the delegates that come that came out of New Hampshire, it's split down the middle, even though Bernie Sanders may have gotten a 60% victory in the popular vote.
Well, and focusing on the next set of elections here in the Granite State, Josh Rogers, I saw on Kelly Ayotte's site this morning saying the big losers out of New Hampshire are Jean Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, because they were such strong backers of Hillary Clinton. How does this big loss for Hillary Clinton here in New Hampshire play for those candidates?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting to think about, and I guess we'll see. I mean, certainly the Democratic establishment, all the elected officials from, you know, Senator Shaheen to dog catcher, were quick to sort of yoke themselves to the Clintons. Whether or not that makes any difference to voters, I don't know. But they are all very tight with Clinton. Senator Shaheen, you know, more pointedly, you know, Governor Hassan is going to be going against Kelly Ayotte. You know, she was the first person to greet Hillary Clinton after the debate that was at UNH, and she was out there campaigning with her with a sort of clutch of, you know, current U.S. Senate women. And she's been a Clinton loyalist for some time, and we'll see how that plays.
Andy?
Energy and enthusiasm make a big difference in presidential elections. I think that if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, which it's still odds are that she's the nominee, I don't think you're going to see the enthusiasm for her that was expressed in the primary for Sanders, that it's going to be more difficult for all of those Republicans who have been yoked, as Josh says, to Clinton to be able to show that they are the new dynamic face of the Democratic Party and attract those young people to the polls.
And that's one thing that both Sanders and Trump I'm going to be looking for is, like, will we see candidates emerging at the state level who, you know, see themselves as messengers for those messages.
Sure. So does the big Sanders win pull New Hampshire Democrats more to the left, Josh? Ken Rudin, final word from you. Where are you heading out next?
I'm going to be in Cincinnati in the next couple of weeks. And, of course, people are looking at the Ohio March 15th primary, see if there's still life with John Kasich.
Okay. And that's a big primary. We'll be following all of this, of course. I want to thank all of you very much for coming in. A long day, a long night. Really appreciate your time. Josh Rogers, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Laura.
That's NHPR's senior political reporter, Josh Rogers. Ken Rudin, great to see you. Thank you.
See you in 2020.
Okay. Ken Rudin, his website is krpoliticaljunkie.com. And Andy Smith, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Good to see you too, Laura.
Andy Smith, associate professor of political science at UNH, director of the UNH Survey Center. This is The Exchange on NHPR.